Later, Parrish and Fanshawe came into the library and saw him in the armchair at the far end, reading. They joined him and spoke with him for several minutes before the alarm was raised. According to Boyne, he remained in the chair in the library the whole time. Sebastian shifted his weight. His eyes narrowed, his gaze distant. He said,
"I left the dining room a minute or so after Boyne. I didn't see him, but if he'd gone into the library, I wouldn't have. I did glimpse Filbury and Wilson strolling down the passage alongside the gun room. They looked to be heading for the door to the rear terrace, which fits with what they said."
He paused, then frowned.
"When Filbury and Wilson went out onto the rear terrace, they should have been able to see Boyne walking down the library. If they happened to glance that way, and the curtains hadn't been drawn."
Sebastian met Crawford's eyes.
"You might ask Filbury and Wilson if they noticed Boyne in the library."
Crawford nodded and made a note in the back of his notebook.
"I paused in the front hall and checked the time."
Sebastian went on.
"It was just coming up to 9:45. I didn't want to get caught in my conversation with the other guests. I didn't want to have to excuse myself at 10 o'clock and indirectly call attention to my meeting with Ennis. So I went out of the front door and onto the front terrace, the stretch that runs beside the drawing room. There was no one in the drawing room. The ladies were in the music room. So I knew no one would spot me and come to chat. I waited on the terrace. It was quiet outside. And now I think of it, I heard the billiards room door open and shut twice. That must have been Filbury and Wilson returning, one after the other. That was only a few minutes before I returned inside. I waited until 9:58, then went in via the front door. I walked down the front hall, into the side corridor, and so to the study."
He paused, letting the memories roll through his mind.
"While I was in the front hall, I remember hearing the ladies in the music room, and then Blanchard walked out through the servants' door, pushing the tea trolley. He saw me and nodded, then went on to the music room. I turned into the corridor leading to the study. The clock started to whir, but underneath that, I remember hearing the murmur of men's voices as I walked along the corridor. That must have been Boyne, Fanshawe and Parrish in the library. Then the clocks chimed the hour. I reached the study door, which was ajar, as the last chime was fading. I heard the clink of billiard balls. The door to the billiards room is at the end of that corridor, and the door was open, but from where I stood, outside the study door, I couldn't see anyone in the billiards room."
Crawford had been scribbling madly. He paused and looked at what he'd written. "That's a good bit more detail than you mentioned before, but it all fits with where everyone else says they were." He flicked back to his earlier notes. "The only others to account for are Parrish and Fanshawe, who had remained in the dining room. Parrish says they finally got up from the table at about 10:05, and ambled into the library. They saw Boyne sitting in an armchair at the far end of the room, and walked down and started chatting. They were still chatting when all hell broke loose. And that fits with what you said." Antonia looked from the inspector to Sebastian, then back again.
"So, where does that leave us?"
The inspector was starting to look a trifle worn down. Crawford scratched his temple with the end of his pencil, then sighed. "If we discard any notion of conspiracy and agree this is all just one man, one murderer with no help from anyone else, then there are three men who might have done it, three who were out of sight of any others for long enough during the critical time. But even for those three, it would have been tight, very tight." Crawford glanced at Sebastian. "I had another chat with the doctor. Sound man, ex-army.
I asked how long he thought Ennis might have hung on after he was stabbed and fell. The doctor's estimate was 5 minutes, 7 at the very outside. Sebastian narrowed his eyes. That leaves us with Filbury, Wilson and Boyne as potential candidates for the role of murderer. Crawford nodded. Either Filbury or Wilson could have doubled back, returned through that rear terrace door near the gunroom, then gone to the study. There was a decent window of time for either of them to have done that, when none of your others were in the front hall. Then they stabbed Ennis, left through the study window, and joined the others in the billiards room. And that's the one scenario that gives a purpose to that open window. He shuffled through his notes. Boyne, he had time to come out of the library and go to the study, but it's harder to see how he could have returned to the library in time. Even going out through the window and in again through that rear terrace door, he would have had to avoid crossing paths with Wilson and Filbury as they headed to the billiards room, or being seen by Fanshawe and Parrish as they left the dining room. Crawford shook his head. It's difficult to see how he might have managed it, time-wise. Sebastian grimaced. All three are Anglo-Irish, and all three spend a good part of their time in Ireland. There's also that snippet of conversation we overheard in the conservatory, Filbury and Wilson asking about conditions on Ennis's Irish estate. Sir Humphrey and I tried to ask them about that. Crawford's expression hardened. Let's just say both were evasive. They certainly didn't want to reveal, much less discuss, whatever the matter giving rise to that conversation was. Antonia studied Sebastian's frowning expression and the inspector's puzzled face. She cleared her throat. I hesitate to mention it, but there's one other possible candidate for the role of murderer. Someone from outside who came to the house in secret. Ennis was expecting him. She looked at Sebastian. Perhaps as part of his revelations to you. Ennis opened the window and let this man in. Having learned that Ennis was preparing to speak to the authorities, the man killed Ennis, then escaped via the window. Crawford shot her a glum, distinctly unhappy look. No. Still frowning, Sebastian shook his head. It can't have been that. Crawford perked up. Why not? Because while that neatly accounts for Ennis's murder, a mysterious man from outside the house party can't account for Cecilia's murder. Sebastian grimaced and met Crawford's gaze. Not unless you're willing to entertain the possibility of two different murderers. Crawford groaned. Heaven help us, no. He closed his notebook and tucked it back inside his coat. One murderer is bad enough. No need to imagine a second. Sebastian grunted. I agree. Antonia had been picturing where all the men had been, like a play on a stage with characters moving here and there. Of our three men who might be guilty, Connell Boyne was out of sight of anyone else for the longest period of time. Crawford nodded. True. But he's also the one it's hardest to see being able to stab Ennis in the study late enough to fit the doctor's timetable, then get back to where he was seen several minutes before Lord Erith here raised the alarm. The inspector grimaced. He's Ennis's brother, too. Not that that makes him any less likely as the murderer, sad to say. As to that, Antonia said, another possibility we haven't properly canvassed is whether the motive for these murders is something quite other. She looked at Sebastian. Something not in any way linked to Ennis's message for Winchelsea. Both Sebastian and the inspector stared at her impassively. Then Crawford heaved another sigh. And that's entirely possible too. Sebastian snorted. If it comes to that, Blanchard could have done the deed. He, or any of the staff, had as much opportunity as any of the guests. Crawford nodded. I'll be interviewing the staff again tomorrow. We'll see where that gets us.
We can discount the obvious other motive, Sebastian said. Ennis had at least one son, so his heir isn't his brother Connell, so the inheritance can't be a motive in these murders.
There are two sons, Antonia put in. Cecilia mentioned they were at boarding school.
Poor tykes. They haven't been told yet, Crawford said. Sir Humphrey is getting Ennis's solicitor down tomorrow, and we're hoping he can take on the estate for the moment. Until we free Connell Boyne of suspicion in his brother's murder, no matter the motive, it isn't appropriate for him to take up the reins.
Crawford looked at Sebastian, then at Antonia. Sir Humphrey and I would appreciate it if you both could keep your eyes on our three prime suspects. It's possible that our villain will let something slip when he's in what he deems less threatening company. Antonia added her agreement to Sebastian's. Then Crawford nodded politely, and they parted, the inspector heading back down to the stable while, arm in arm, she and Sebastian continued to the house. Sebastian and Antonia entered the house with just enough time to bathe and dress for dinner. They met in the corridor outside their rooms and descended to the drawing room, side by side. Once inside the room, they halted. Both surveyed the subdued company. Then they met each other's eyes, and in wordless accord, separated. Antonia strolled to join the ladies gathered on the sofas before the fireplace. A roaring blaze sent heat into the room, but seemed unable to lift the chill from the company's collective spirits. Mrs. McGibbon and Mrs. Parrish looked much older tonight. They sat with their heads together, conversing in murmurs. Amelie Billhurst, quiet but holding her own, sat beside Melinda Boyne and was patently attempting to keep Melinda's spirits up, a task at which she wasn't succeeding all that well. Melinda looked spooked. Antonia wondered if Melinda, a Boyne after all, knew anything about the murders, or anything that might shed some light on who the murderer might be. But Claire, Melissa, and Georgia, all with somber expressions on their faces, were waiting to draw Antonia down to sit on the arm of the sofa the three shared.
Where did you get to today? Georgia asked.
Antonia hid a grimace.
I went with Sebastian to check on nearby farms for Sir Humphrey and the inspector, asking if they'd noticed any strangers about. Sebastian didn't want to leave me here alone. Well, without him.
A twist on the truth, perhaps, but essentially true.
Well, it's been deadly here, Melissa whispered. They, Sir Humphrey and that inspector, questioned us all one by one.
Not that any of us have been able to tell them anything, Georgia said.
Have you any word on when we might be allowed to leave?
Claire asked.
With two murders to solve, I don't think Sir Humphrey and the inspector are yet ready to allow anyone to depart.
Antonia glanced across the room and saw that Sebastian was surrounded by the men, no doubt being questioned, much as she was. Other than glum rumblings of discontent, nothing of note was said in her hearing before Blanchard appeared and announced that dinner was served. Sebastian came to give her his arm, a signal for others to adhere to the social habit and pair up, which they did. As a company of couples, they trooped into the dining room and claimed seats as they would. No one made any move to sit in the carvers at either end of the table. Blanchard surveyed the company, then proceeded to serve the meal with butlerish imperturbability, as if not having a master or mistress present was an irregularity he was determined to ignore. The meal was consumed largely in silence, a sober, even somber, and exceedingly weighty silence, broken only by occasional murmurs as people commented desultorily on this or that. At the end of the meal, Mrs. Parrish and Mrs. McGibbon exchanged a glance. Then both rose, bringing the rest of the company to their feet. With nods, the ladies departed for the drawing-room, clearly assuming the gentlemen would want their port. But after exchanging glances themselves, the gentlemen, led by the married men, who seemed to feel the need to remain within sight of their wives, fell in and trailed in the ladies' wake into the drawing-room. Sebastian was only too happy to stroll with Hadley to where the younger ladies had gathered at one side of the room. He gained Antonia's side as Georgia Fanshawe, looking longingly out of the window at the front drive, murmured, "I wonder how long we'll be stuck here." Hadley caught her hand and squeezed it.
"I'm sure they won't keep us much longer, not once they've gathered all the information they need."
Georgia summoned a weak smile and trained it on her husband. Sebastian exchanged a look with Antonia, but neither of them said anything. Informing the company that they might well be held there for days yet, or until the murderer was caught, wouldn't raise anyone's spirits. Claire Savage shook herself, then raised her head, and somewhat bravely said,
"I heard there's a new play in production at the Theatre Royal. Has anyone heard more?"
After an instant of something akin to shock, Melissa Wainwright leapt in to share what she'd heard. Gradually, minute by minute, although the atmosphere remained strained, it became clear that the general consensus was to carry on as best they could and ignore, as best they could, the pall the murders had cast. Difficult, given the company was lacking both host and hostess, but they gamely soldiered on. But when Blanchard wheeled in the tea trolley, he was greeted with an undercurrent of relief. Mrs. Parrish and Mrs. McGibbon shared the honours, and all the gentlemen leapt to assist by ferrying the cups around. As soon as the tea had been consumed, the company, still moving, as if with one mind, rose, and everyone stated their intention to retire. En masse, they moved out of the drawing-room and started up the stairs. Following at Antonia's heels, Sebastian detected a certain watchful wariness arising, no doubt from latent yet unspecific and undirected suspicion that seemed to have afflicted everyone.
"Anyone for billiards?"
Along with all the other men, Sebastian glanced down to see Connell Boyne hovering at the foot of the stairs. Boyne scanned the faces in a half-hearted way. His tone hadn't suggested any real enthusiasm, more as if he thought he ought to offer the invitation. Murmurs in the negative came from all the other men. Sebastian briefly shook his head and continued climbing in Antonia's wake. On gaining the gallery, he looked down into the hall and saw Connell, left alone on the tiles, vacillating, clearly debating whether to come upstairs or head for the billiards room. In the end, Connell thrust his hands into his trouser pockets and slouched slowly off, toward the library or the corridor to the billiards room. Sebastian couldn't tell which. He turned and followed Antonia and the Fanshawes into the east wing. Sebastian dawdled in the corridor outside his room until Hadley and Georgia had gone into theirs and the door had shut behind them. The instant it did, he turned and walked silently back along the corridor, scratched at Antonia's door, then opened it and walked in. She was seated at the dressing table, her arms raised as she pulled a pin from her hair. She levelled a look he couldn't quite read at him. He ignored it and quietly shut the door.
"Have you rung for your maid?"
"No, not yet."
"Good, don't."
He crossed to where a straight-backed chair stood against the wall, lifted it, turned it, and set it down behind and a little to one side of the dressing stool. So when he straddled it and sat, resting his forearms on the raised back, he could see Antonia's face in the dressing table mirror. She arched a haughty brow at him.
You presume.
He snorted softly.
Did you really imagine I would allow my de facto affianced marchioness to sleep alone and unprotected under the same roof as a murderer?
She looked at him, then lightly shrugged.
Put like that, I suppose not.
He had the distinct impression that despite her neutral expression, she was laughing at him. She was amused, at the very least. She returned her attention to freeing her long hair.
Did you hear anything useful?
Nothing at all. You?
Likewise. But while no one has actually said the words, and despite the lady's earlier talk of gypsies or an itinerant being responsible for killing Ennis, it's clear the realization that there's almost certainly a murderer among us has started to sink in and take hold.
Ah, that was what was behind the men sticking by their wives' sides, and the company as a whole acting like a herd.
I dare say such behaviour is natural in the circumstances.
She withdrew a last pin, and the mass of her hair tumbled free. A rippling wave of black silk, it reached down her back, almost to her hips.
His palms itched. His gaze had already fixed on the blackest, deepest night waterfall.
She reached for her brush. He watched as she raised it, and set the bristles to that silken mane, and slowly drew the brush down. Hypnotized by the unbidden, innocent sensuality of the repetitive, rhythmic movement as she continued to brush the long tresses, his gaze remained transfixed, his senses flaring, even as he wondered. Pondered. Control. How effortlessly she tried his, how she challenged it. Even unintentionally, as now. On a flash of insight, he realized why. Why she and only she had always possessed the power to deflect and distract him. Because he couldn't control how he felt about her, how he reacted and responded to her, over her, about her. When he was with her, not only in a bedchamber, but wherever they happened to be, there was no such thing as control, as his customary absolute and inviolable mastery over himself and all he did. When he was with her, control faded and lost its hold. When he was with her, he was driven by instinct, by reactions and feelings. Feelings engendered by an emotion too powerful to deny. He blinked back to the present, to the faint shush as she plied her brush, and frowned. In the mirror, her gaze flicked to his face, then fastened on his eyes. To excuse the frown, he said the first words that slid into his mind, into the space vacated as that too powerful emotion eased its hold on his wits.
Where the devil is Ennis's gunpowder?
His frustration had bubbled up and infused the words. He crossed his forearms on the upper edge of the chair's back and leaned his chin on them.
More. What's the damn stuff for? Who organized for it to be here, wherever here is? And is it still here, wherever here is? Or has it already been spirited away?
She switched her gaze forward, staring into the mirror, as if focusing on some distant point beyond her own reflection, she continued to steadily wield her brush.
It was only 2 nights ago that Ennis used his last words to tell you the gunpowder was here. There's been no evidence of any relevant activity around the house and grounds, so taking the simplest interpretation of his words, presumably the gunpowder is still here, wherever here is.
He grunted, grumbled.
If they, whoever they are, learned Ennis was about to betray their plot and were in a position to kill him before he could, then surely they would also have moved the gunpowder at the same time, on that night.
Only if they could. If they could arrange to move it
and could risk moving it immediately. She paused in her brushing, head tilted as she thought. Then she resumed the slow, evocative stroking. And only if the gunpowder was already here. Ennis might have meant the gunpowder was on its way here. If it had already been moved on, he would have told you, or at least tried to tell you, where it was going. He turned all the aspects, all the disconnected elements of the situation, over in his mind. I keep coming back to the apparently inescapable truth that, in light of Ennis's last words, the question of whether Ennis and Cecilia were killed because of this plot or for some other reason is entirely beside the point. It's impossible to make sense of the motive for their murders, even to be sure that they're connected, without knowing who the murderer is. True. But why they were murdered doesn't change the fact that we came here with a specific goal in mind, to receive Ennis's message for Drake. We have that message, such as it is. Gunpowder, here, that's all we have. And given the effort Ennis made to give me those words, it's most likely those words are, in fact, the gist of what he wanted to communicate. So we've done what we came here to do. In the mirror, he met her gaze. We could leave tomorrow. Sir Humphrey and Crawford won't try to stop us. We could return to London and put everything we've learned into Drake's hands. He grimaced, assuming he's back. But even if he isn't, we could place our information into the hands of his masters in Whitehall. Antonia set down her brush, swiveled to face him, and rapidly searched his face. After a moment she said,
"We could, but we're not going to. Are we?"
His gaze shifted from hers. All she got was a faint grimace in reply. She went on, as if she hadn't noticed, feeling her way through his thoughts.
"You've already sent word to Whitehall. Wellington's imprimatur would have ensured the message got delivered with all speed to the right people."
She studied Sebastian's expression. What little of his feelings she could read from it. Frustration, disgruntlement, disappointment, yes. But not defeat. Never that. She made an educated guess.
"Correct me if I'm wrong, but there aren't that many of you, are there? Gentlemen like you who occasionally work for Drake, who step in when, for whatever reason, he can't do something."
His gaze returned to her face. Several seconds elapsed, then he shrugged.
"As far as I know, Drake relies on only a handful of sons of the nobility."
"Exactly."
Knowing Drake, she hadn't imagined anything else. High-handed selectiveness was entirely in keeping with the Marquis of Winchelsea's character.
"And Drake left for Ireland when?"
He had to think back.
"On the 16th or 17th.
So 5 or 6 days ago. And I also assume that he isn't swanning about Ireland as the Marquis of Winchelsea."
"I seriously doubt it."
"So even if he'd been able to travel rapidly on this side of the Irish Sea, even if he's been able to complete his business over there in just a few days, which I take it is unlikely, then he wouldn't return to London until tomorrow, or the next day, or more likely, some days after that."
He held her gaze levelly.
"There's nothing in your assessment with which I disagree. However,
bear with me."
She tried to see what lay behind his pale green eyes. What was driving this? A wish to take her back to London, leave her there, and then return? That she could believe.
"Your letter to Whitehall would have been received this morning. As I understand matters, it's highly unlikely they can or will send anyone else down to look for this gunpowder. Yet gunpowder is a word that conjures up destruction. And just attempting to convey that word to Drake was enough to get Ennis killed. As Wellington said,
Having received Ennis's message, our goal now must be to locate the gunpowder. She paused, continuing to hold Sebastian's gaze. Ennis died to get those two words to you, to Drake. To people who would care enough to do something about it, to stop whatever destruction is planned. You can't turn aside.
Finally, she caught the flash of something she recognized in the back of his eyes. Offended pride, which he immediately buried. Sure, at last, on what ground she stood, she let her lips curve, just slightly.
And you're not going to convince me that you ever would. And I'm not about to sit meekly and let you wrap me in cotton batting and tuck me away somewhere safe while you continue to search for the damned gunpowder.
He sat up and uncrossed his arms. Before he could growl a word, she rose and caught one of his hands.
I'm now a part of this too. You involved me, and so did Drake. You can hardly complain over the outcome. Now,
she tugged on his hand. She didn't want him dwelling on that for too long.
Stop being such a grump. We still have the northern half of the estate to search tomorrow. And yes, I will be searching it with you.
He looked disgusted, but at her insistent tugging, got to his feet.
It was worth a try.
She threw him a look, disapproving but resigned, as she drew him around, then backing toward the bed. She allowed thoughts of a completely different nature to infuse her gaze.
We can't do anything more until tomorrow.
The atmosphere between them changed, in just a heartbeat, to one of leaping senses and tightening nerves. She smiled, confidence and self-assurance rising.
Come to bed.
Her voice had grown sultry.
I guarantee you'll see matters in a more positive light come morning.
His gaze remained locked with hers, his brows slowly rose, and he allowed her to tow him toward the bed. Mentally, Sebastian threw up his hands, surrendering, even if he wasn't entirely sure to what. To compulsion, yes. To hunger, definitely. To need? As she halted by the bed, grabbed the sides of his coat in both fists and hauled him to her as she stretched up, and he bent his head, it certainly felt like that. Their lips met, and that swelling need ignited. No tentative dipping of toes into desire's sea, not for them. The tide raged, and they plunged in, and it swept them, swirled them, then dragged them under. And they went, gladly jettisoning all vestige of restraint and all pretense of rational decision, with blatant abandon. They let passion have them. Their lips meshed and melded, their mouths devoured, greedy and needy. Then she parted her lips, and he thrust his tongue past and claimed every lush inch of her mouth. He possessed and branded, in flagrant mimicry of what was to come. Then her tongue boldly tangled with his, and they fell into a duel of wills and wants, and he lost his last anchor to the world. She pushed, she challenged, and he instinctively met her, on this plane, as on all others. Ardour burned brightly within them both, a near incandescent flame. It heated, it lured, it drew and drove them on. Into ever-escalating hungers, into turbulent seas of passions unleashed. Desire burned, a fire in their blood, and hunger and need thudded in their veins. And compulsion reigned. Her small hands were everywhere, tugging at his clothes. He finished unbuttoning her gown, then acquiesced to her insistence and shrugged off his coat and waistcoat, both of which she'd already undone. An errant thought whisked through his mind. One day, they might manage to take this slowly,
to draw the moments out. But that day was not today. Driven by something that was close to desperation, an increasingly urgent need to feel the other close, that close, they shed clothes like leaves, swept away by the gale of their need. Until they came together, skin to skin, senses to achingly yearning senses, bodies flush and limbs embracing in the space beside her bed. Hands, hers and his, reached, stroked, and caressed. On a panting breath, he broke from the kiss and sent his lips cruising over the delicate curve of her jaw, down the long column of her throat, following the sculpted line of her shoulder wide, before swooping down to pay homage to one breast. He filled his hand with her other breast, kneaded the already swollen mound as he suckled, and she cried out, her fingers digging into his scalp as she arched in his arms. As her naked hips pressed tight, then provocatively ground against his bare thighs, they stilled, all breathing suspended. Their eyes met for a fleeting instant, then they tumbled onto the coverlet, landing in a tangle of long limbs and searching, grasping, greedy hands. He seized the moment of unscripted wrestling to catch his breath, physically and mentally, and reached for what, in that sphere, passed for patience. For some lever, anything, that would slow them down. Control might be beyond him, but surely experience would afford him some ability to at least guide. She wasn't of a mind to allow it. She caught his head between her hands and yanked him back into a searing kiss, one that cindered all restraint. Then she undulated beneath him, her body sinuously tempting in a move as old as time. He reacted. It was impossible not to keep his body from answering her call, from covering her, settling heavily into the cradle of her hips, into the embrace of her slender, welcoming thighs, and then, with one thrust, he was inside her. Pleasure, laced by something far more profound, more acute, infinitely more heady, lanced through him. The jolt was a sensual shock, potent enough, glorious enough, to make him draw back from the kiss, simply to better savor it. From beneath his lashes, he looked into her face. Shadowed though it was, he saw her eyes gleam from beneath her weighted lids. For an instant, their gazes locked, held, and an ineluctable sense of togetherness welled, clicked, locked, and bound them, an invisible strand, one of pure physical sharing, a connection nonetheless, one they'd both intuitively reached for. In that split-second exchange, he and she both acknowledged that reality. Then her lashes lowered, and her lips curved. He bent his head, covered those alluring lips with his, and together they plunged into their fire. They rode and burned, gripped and clung. Antonia thrilled to the beat, to the heavy, repetitive rhythm of their joining. Her skin was aflame, while he was pure heat. The sensation of his body moving on hers, against hers, into hers, sent her senses spinning, spiraling through a universe of ever-expanding awareness, of touch, of fire, of molten heat, of the thud of their hearts, the compulsive surge and retreat, and the steady rise of that glorious, scintillating tension. Almost there. She gasped, clung, sobbed, and urged him on. The climax rushed up, an eruption of sensation that wiped all else before it, and exploded across her senses in a starburst of glittering, unadulterated pleasure. leaving behind a clean slate, and an emptiness that, a second later, he joined her and filled. As if they were two halves of one entity. An entity formed through long association, perhaps, yet forged in this fire, welded in this furnace of passion and desire. Her senses slowly returned to earth. She realized he'd collapsed upon her, heavy muscles and bones slumped, wrung out in abject surrender, and felt her lips spontaneously curve. If anyone had told her mere days ago that she would welcome his weight lying so heavily on her, trapping her and pressing her into the bed, she wouldn't have believed them. But now, lazily, languidly, she lifted her arms, reached as far around him as she could, and held him to her. There was a sharing in this moment, an intimate closeness that nothing else and no other situation could even aspire to. She held that closeness to her as she held him. She closed her eyes and let her mind drift into the beckoning, blissful oblivion. Eventually, Sebastian returned to the land of the living. He had no idea how much time had elapsed, which was unusual, to say the least. Slowly, he raised his head, taking care not to jar Antonia awake. He looked down into her sleeping face, drank in her expression, Madonna-like in its moon-wash serenity, and mentally shook his head. He'd had women beyond counting, yet he couldn't recall ever being this. Wrung out? Hollowed out? Whatever it was. So deeply sunk in the moment, so deeply enthralled, so profoundly connected and exorcised, that it took such a long time for him to reconnect with the world. Moving slowly and carefully, he disengaged from her clinging embrace, then slumped beside her in the bed. He reached down, freed the covers, and tugged them over their cooling bodies. He felt ridiculously gratified when she turned on her side and, apparently still asleep, snuggled against him. He settled one arm around her, holding her close, then feeling oddly mind clear and nowhere near sleep, he raised his other arm, put his hand behind his head, and stared up at the ceiling. Unsurprisingly, his thoughts circled the conundrum curled, a warm and soft armful by his side. She'd always been there, a part of his world, as far back as his memories ran. She'd always been different in some unspecified way, occupying a slightly different category than anyone else. She'd been one of the few, possibly the only person inside his inner palisade, able to connect with him on a different, more personal, more direct, and no subjects barred plane. That connection had been outside his control, not something he'd allowed so much as something that had simply been. A link she had, from her earliest years, instinctively exploited and used. Yet when he'd started looking for a wife, he hadn't thought of her. If he was honest, he specifically hadn't thought of her. Because he hadn't wanted to risk what she could, would, do to his ability to control himself, her, them. But now they'd flung caution aside, and there they were, with their feet inexorably following a path into matrimony. How was he, were they, to manage? Instinct, more primitive than educated, suggested he would be wise to set all thoughts of control aside, witness his signal lack of success that evening. Even had he succeeded, she would have realized all too soon and wouldn't have readily forgiven him and would, no doubt, have taken steps to counter his manipulation, steps of which he wouldn't have approved and wouldn't have liked. Trying to exert control, even by his favoured method of subtle manipulation, might well lead to worse problems than any he sought to solve. Now they'd embarked on this path, he needed to accept that reality. He would never control her, and she would never control him. So where did that leave them? As essentially equal partners, with different abilities and different strengths, yet on a par with each other, as powerful as each other in this domain they were creating and shaping between them. The landscape of their future, of the life they would share. He stared unseeing at the ceiling. He had to admit there was temptation of a sort in that challenge, for it would be a challenge, of that he had no doubt. He dipped his chin and glanced down at her, at the curve of her face he could see. Resolution, determination, strength, much of what he recognized in her, he knew also lived in him. He'd lowered his arm. Caught in his web of contemplation, of her, of them, he ran a gentle finger down her nose. Like the rest of her, it was long, but in perfect proportion with the rest of her face. He shifted his attention to one lithely muscled arm and traced its length with his palm. He loved. His mind froze. After a moment, he tentatively considered, for once truly looked, then he shied away from the thought. But he didn't bury it, just left it, unaccepted, but not dismissed. He'd heard all the tales of sinsters marrying only for love, always for love, that any attempt to do otherwise, like his great-uncle Arthur's first marriage, was doomed. But the stories of the grand dames were just stories, weren't they? What currency did they have in the modern world? In the world he and Antonia inhabited? Another set of questions to which he didn't have answers. He didn't need more frustrations. Satiation still lay heavy in his veins. He closed his eyes, opened his awareness to the mind-numbing sensation, embraced the bone-deep glow, and surrendered to whatever dreams awaited him. Chapter 13. Sebastian left Antonia's room and returned to his as late as he dared, gaining his bed just before a footman crept in to lay and light the fire. Once the footman had gone, Sebastian lay beneath the covers he'd artistically disarranged and weighed up competing compulsions. Should he make another, most likely futile, bid to somehow convince Antonia to remain in safety with the other ladies? Or should he acknowledge his newly recognized reality and accept that she would be riding out with him? In the end, he realized that with a murderer among the guests, even with Sir Humphrey, Inspector Crawford, and the constables around the house, his inner self did not deem the company sufficiently safe for her, not without him by her side. He wasn't sure how to regard that conclusion. Was it realization or rationalization? Regardless, with his way forward clarified, he rose, washed and dressed, and was loitering in the archway leading to the gallery when Antonia emerged from her room. She saw him and arched a faintly haughty brow, but made no other comment. That she donned her riding habit was a sufficient declaration of her expectations of the day. They walked side by side through the gallery and down the stairs. As they stepped onto the tiles of the front hall, she murmured, "It appears to be a good morning. Given the lack of screams, it seems no one died in the night." He humphed. A footman was passing, ferrying an empty dish back to the kitchen. Sebastian halted him and asked for a message to be relayed to the stables. To have the horses he and Antonia had ridden the previous day saddled and waiting in half an hour. The footman bowed and retreated. Antonia had halted and waited, listening. As Sebastian turned back to her, she bestowed an approving smile on him, then she turned and walked on. Schooling his features to impassivity, he followed her into the breakfast room. They greeted the other guests already present, all the younger crew except for the Fanshawes, then helped themselves from the sideboard. After piling several sausages onto a mound of kedgeree, Sebastian eyed the excellent spread laid out along the board.
With both master and mistress dead, who is running the household? Do you know?
I believe Blanchard and Mrs. Blanchard have stepped up to the mark, and Mrs. Parrish has offered to assist if needed.
A plate containing one slice of toast, a small mound of scrambled eggs, and one slice of ham in her hand, Antonia turned from the sideboard, surveyed the table, then elected to sit beside Claire and Melissa at one end. Her friends eyed her riding habit with ill-concealed envy.
"Half your luck," Claire grumbled, as Antonia set down her plate and paused to allow Sebastian, who had of course followed at her heels, to draw out the chair beside Claire's for her. Claire went on. "I take it you plan to ride out again today?"
Antonia sank onto the chair.
"Yes."
She glanced at Sebastian as he circled the end of the table and helpfully claimed the place opposite her. She briefly met his eyes. He hadn't heard the excuse for their absence she'd given her friends the previous day.
"So far, we've covered only half the area Sir Humphrey and the inspector asked us to check for strangers. With luck, we'll finish today." "Well," Melissa said, "I sincerely hope Sir Humphrey and the inspector bring their investigations to a speedy conclusion, so we can leave tomorrow, as planned. I had to get out of bed at cock's crow to move the chair I'd wedged against my door, so the tweeny could come in." "Cecilia had planned a ball for tonight."
Claire put down the slice of toast she'd been nibbling and reached for her teacup.
"But I understand Sir Humphrey has sent word to all the neighbours, informing them of the murders and asking them to stay away."
"Just as well," Antonia said. "This is the country. News of the murders is sure to have spread by now, and as we all know, nothing short of an instruction from a magistrate is likely to keep the curious at bay."
"That's the last thing we need," Melissa stated, "having to receive the local gossips all agog for the scandalous highlights."
"Actually," Sebastian murmured, his gaze on his plate, "the last thing any of us need is the press."
Melissa and Claire stared at him.
"What a horrendous idea!"
Claire sounded aghast. After a second, she asked,
"When do you think they'll arrive?"
Sebastian looked at Melissa and Claire.
"When did Sir Humphrey send word to the neighbours?"
"Yesterday,"
Melissa said.
"Mrs. Parrish mentioned the ball to him, and he said he would call at the appropriate houses and ensure the word was spread throughout the neighbourhood."
Sebastian's expression turned cynical. 24 hours for the news to reach Fleet Street, then 12 or so hours before the hounds reach here.
If we are released tomorrow, even if the constables succeed in keeping the newsman off the property, you can expect to run a gauntlet at the gate.
A short silence fell, while Antonia exchanged horrified glances with her friends as they digested that unwelcome prediction. Melissa slumped.
"This was our first excursion out from under our mother's wings. We'll never be allowed out alone again."
Claire pulled a disgusted face. Sebastian grinned.
"Wear veils and have your coachman whip up the horses 20 yards before the gate. The good gentlemen of the press will be too busy scrambling for their lives to notice who you are.
much less demand answers to unwelcome questions.
Melissa and Claire considered that image. Both perked up. Sebastian pushed aside his empty plate and caught Antonia's eye.
We should get going.
Yes, all right.
She drained her teacup, pushed back her chair, and rose. She glanced at Melissa and Claire, who were once again regarding her with resigned envy.
Pray God nothing else bothersome happens today.
Amen,
Melissa said.
And that Sir Humphrey and the inspector either find the murderer, or else decide he's flown, and allow us to go home.
Claire flashed a weak grin at Antonia.
Have fun.
Antonia hesitated, then replied,
Take care.
She looked at Melissa as well.
Both of you.
And tell Georgia too.
Oh, all the ladies plan to stick together,
Melissa said.
It's boring, but we all feel safer that way.
Sebastian, who had risen as Antonia had, and circled the table to pull back her chair, nodded in approval.
An excellent idea.
He glanced at Antonia, hesitated for a second, then waved to the door giving onto the rear terrace.
Let's walk around, rather than go through the house.
With a last smile for her friends, and a nod to the others about the table, Antonia led the way. Sebastian reached around her and opened the door, then followed her out and closed the glass pane behind them. The day was overcast, but although darker clouds were massing to the north, there was no scent of rain, and the breeze, blowing fitfully from the west, was mild. They went down the steps from the terrace to the lawn, then strode side by side around the short central wing, which at ground level housed the kitchen and associated facilities. A brick wall enclosed the kitchen garden, but archways in both side walls allowed them to walk through to emerge on the lawn below the rear terrace, running beside the library. They cut across toward the stable, eventually joining the path from the side door. Antonia noticed Sebastian studying the house as they walked.
What are you looking for?
Any sign of unexpected basements, of anywhere we haven't yet searched.
He faced forward as they left the house behind.
I swear we've searched all possible places inside the house.
She nodded, and continued to wonder at his apparent ready acceptance of her company. After his attempt to remove her from the house party, and all danger last night, she'd expected him to try again, or at least to try to dissuade her from accompanying him. She would have sworn that in the moment when they'd taken their leave of Melissa and Claire, and he'd hesitated, he'd debated suggesting she remain with her friends in safety. But he hadn't. Instead, he seemed not just resigned, but acquiescent over her presence. That was a great deal more than she'd hoped for. Almost as if, with respect to her, he was changing his spots. Only she didn't believe that for an instant. She and her sister had heard countless tales from their mother of their father's smothering protectiveness, and had endured enough incidents of that on their own accounts to have formed a very clear idea of the only possible way to deal with a similar man, with a nobleman who, when in the grip of instinct, would behave as if he owned them, as if they were somehow his to dictate to, at least when there was any danger involved. She wasn't foolish enough to discard or denigrate the protectiveness such men like Sebastian, personified. Protectiveness was welcome. Any sane lady would agree. But possessive protectiveness was something else again, and needed to be guarded against, needed to be trained out of those so afflicted. She bit back a smile. Sebastian wouldn't see that conclusion as amusing, much less approve of such attack. Too bad. That was the price if he wanted her hand in marriage. They reached the stable yard to find their mounts waiting. When Sebastian lifted her to her saddle, she discovered she now enjoyed the thrill, the spiking of her senses. He mounted up. She enjoyed watching that too. Then they wheeled the horses and clattered out of the yard, only to almost immediately rein in as the inspector, flanked by a bevy of constables, came trotting up. Crawford halted his good-looking bay, doubtless borrowed from Sir Humphrey's stable, waved his men on to the stable yard, then politely lifted his hat to them.
"Good morning, my lord. My lady?"
"Inspector." Sebastian steadied the grey, who had taken exception to the other horses. At the same time, he glanced about, confirming none of the stablemen and no one else was close enough to overhear.
"We're about to ride out and search the northern half of the estate for any sign of the gunpowder."
Crawford nodded. "I don't suppose you've anything enlightening to tell me as to who the murderer might be?"
"Sadly, no," Sebastian said.
Antonia took pity on the inspector.
"Last night, everyone was very subdued. We all retired early. This morning, the main subject of conversation about the breakfast table was whether you will allow us to depart tomorrow, as was originally planned."
Crawford sighed. "That's a decision Sir Humphrey and I will have to make later today. And frankly, I'm not looking forward to it. With all evidence pointing to the murderer being one of the guests, the new rules that apply to investigations such as this say we keep you all here, contained, until something breaks. That said, I could see that's not going to be so easy in this case, and might not even be possible." Sebastian hesitated, then nodded and tightened the grey's reins.
"If anything occurs to us, or if we find anything to point to the murderer, we'll let you know as quickly as we can."
"In that case," Crawford half bowed to Antonia, "I wish you good riding, and good luck." They parted. With Antonia beside him, Sebastian set course for the fields lying to the northwest of the grounds surrounding the house. When they reached the area they hadn't yet explored, once again they zigged and zagged, working their way toward the western boundary, stopping at all structures, no matter how small, to search for hidden barrels. The first place they stopped at was a farmhouse that stood isolated on its own plot. The farmyard with its associated buildings was a short distance away, around the flank of a low hill. Sebastian dismounted and came to lift Antonia down. Together they walked up the gravel path. The door opened before they reached it. The tenant farmer's wife blinked at them, then coloured and bobbed a curtsy.
"Sir, ma'am, what can I do for you?"
Sebastian glanced at Antonia. She smiled at the woman.
"We're searching for some barrels that those at the house," she waved toward Pressingstoke Hall, "believe might have been hidden somewhere about the estate. Have you or your husband seen anyone moving barrels about recently?"
Clearly mystified, the woman shook her head.